So good evening and welcome to Tav Shin Pei Gimel 2023's Haggadah Insights. I've shared for quite a number of years now ideas on the Haggadah in advance of Leil HaSeder, and certainly doing so again this year. There are lots of ideas that I've shared in previous years which are worth repeating, certainly at the Seder table. Some of them address key themes, but don't really want to repeat them tonight. So I think almost everything that I'm sharing with you this evening is new material for this year. But hopefully some of it will be meaningful and good to use at the Seder. Also, just want to develop a few themes a little bit more broadly and think about really what is it that we're trying to achieve with the Magid and Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim. Everybody knows that we say Kol Hamar Belasaper Harizeh Meshubach. The more we speak about Yetziat Mitzrayim, the more praiseworthy it is. And we see from the story of the five rabbis in Bnei Brak that they were able to speak about the Exodus through till the morning. And many people like to share many, many Divrei Torah over the course of the Seder. But what is it that we should exactly be focusing on? I certainly always say that the focus of the Leil HaSeder should be Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim in its broader sense. So it's one of the very interesting things about the Haggadah is that there's relatively little which talks about the events specifically on the night of Yetziat Mitzrayim. There's quite a lot that talks about the slavery in Egypt, and certainly about the miracles that took place, etc., etc. So those are all the themes that we're supposed to expand on. Talking about the four sons and what's the difference between a Chacham and a Rasha and a Tama She'inu Yodea Lishol, all very interesting. Always say there's plenty of Yom Tov meals. They can be discussed at the various Yom Tov meals, etc., etc. The exact identity of the five rabbis and why they were in Bnei Brak, not somewhere else. Again, interesting themes, but they don't really help us fully understand Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim. Certainly, if one looks at the introduction attributed to the Malbim of the Haggadah, he explains that in actual fact, all these things are supposed to really indicate to us the model for Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim. But I'm going to pick up on a few points in the Haggadah and try and really use them to understand what we're talking about on Seder night. So I want to start off with Halach Ma'anya. There's nothing particularly unique about Kiddush and the like on Seder night. Well, there is certain that unique aspect, but the first new text, as it were, that we encounter in the Haggadah is Halach Ma'anya. This is the bread of poverty or affliction which our forefathers ate in the land of Mitzrayim. And at the end of it, we say, Hashata Avdei L'shana Haba'a B'nei Chorin. This year we are slaves, but we hope that next year we're going to be B'nei Chorin. And the question is, how can we say that this year we are slaves? Which one of us are really slaves this year? Baruch Hashem, we're free people. So I read somewhere recently, I can't off the top of my head, I do actually now remember where I read it. I read it in one of Rav Pesach Krohn's books, his Haggadah Shel Pesach. He says that one year Rav Yisrael Meir Lau, the previous chief rabbi of Israel, was leading a Seder for Chayalim. And at the beginning of the Seder, he said this paragraph, and one of the soldiers asked him in a very challenging way, you know, like, what are you talking about? You know, this year we're slaves, next year we hope to be free. This is a load of nonsense. I'm not really interested in the whole evening if, you know, you're talking about things that aren't true. So Rav Lau's answer to him was, that we always look at ourselves as a collective. And whilst it's true that you and I might be free people, nevertheless, there are Jews who live under persecution and live in difficult circumstances, and they're not free. And we're hoping that as a nation as a whole, this year we're not free, and we're hoping that next year we will be free. And I suppose to put it into an up-to-date contemporary context, we should have in mind, particularly, I suppose, Jewish community in Ukraine, for whom it's very difficult throughout the year, and particularly at Pesach. And there still are Jews in various Arab countries where, of course, they're not really free, etc. And we hope that in due course they will be B'nai Chorin. But I found another interpretation in the Haggadah of the Tiferet Shlomo. The Tiferet Shlomo was the first Radomska Rebbe, the Radomska Hasidim. And he says it's not talking about our physical status, but it's talking about our spiritual state. And we're saying, Hashata Avdei, this year, now we serve Hashem as slaves. We don't serve Hashem out of a sense of love. We do the mitzvot because we feel compelled that we have to do them. But we hope that by next year, we'll have elevated ourselves to a greater spiritual level where we feel that we're serving Hashem as B'nai Chorin because we genuinely want to and we are genuinely in love with Hashem. So that's a thought on that opening phrase in Halach Ma'anya. And in actual fact, had a further idea on that's what I wanted to share with you on Halach Ma'anya. Let's move on now to the Manishtana, which is of course a cornerstone of the Haggadah, but in reality is just the introduction to the Maggid rather than anything else. If we look in the Mishnah in the 10th Perek of Masechet Pesachim, tells us Mazgul Kosheni, that we pour the second cup of wine, V'kan HaBen Shoel Et Aviv, and then the child asks the parent. It tells us what these questions are. And a question that, I suppose, a fifth question for the Manishtana is, why are we asking all these questions? What do we mean, why are we asking all these questions? Meaning there are lots of questions we could ask. Why are we particularly asking these four questions? And Rav Yaakov Emden, in his commentary to the Haggadah, he says that each of them shows us a contradiction. Let's think about the matzah. Okay? The matzah, we've just said that it's lachma anya. It's a poor man's bread. But on Seder night, we're celebrating freedom. So if we're celebrating freedom, why are we eating the bread of affliction? Question number two, that's we're eating maror on Seder night. But we do also eat other vegetables. We don't say kulo maror, that we're only eating bitter herbs. We're eating other vegetables as well, which presumably represent freedom. Third question about the dipping. Why are we dipping twice? There's a contradiction there. What does the first dipping seem to suggest? Very interesting idea. That you dip food for two reasons. Either you dip food to stimulate your appetite, or you dip food in order to disguise the taste. If you're wealthy, you'll dip food before your meal to stimulate your gastric juices and get you ready to eat a nice, delicious meal. If you're poor and the food that you've got is bland and stale and a little bit mouldy, etc., you'll dip it in something to disguise the taste. So our first dipping is a symbol of freedom, whereas our second dipping is there to improve the food. And then we've got the leaning, and Haseba itself can represent two things. It can be a sign of freedom, which is what we use it for primarily on Seder night, but also it's a sign of weakness and illness. And, you know, a person who has to slouch and can't sit properly. So we've got lots of contradictions here on Satanite, and that's what we're asking about. Why are we doing things which is both about freedom and also about slavery? And his answer is that that's exactly what tonight is about, or Satanight is about. It's not just about celebrating freedom, but it's also about remembering the slavery. And to develop what he says, I point out that, you know, the Haggadah tells us, and the Mishnah tells us, that how should we answer the questions of the Manishtana? Matchil bignut, umesayim bishvach. We start off by talking about the difficulties of the past, the humble beginnings, the struggles that we had, the persecution in Egypt, umesayim bishvach, and then we finish off talking about the triumphant issue, the triumphant events. And that's exactly what Satanite has to be. This comparison, or this, not just a matter of compare and contrast, but a matter of starting Bignut and Messiah Bishvach. And there are three reasons why you need to remember the bitter past. Number one is this notion of compare and contrast. So it creates a greater appreciation of the present. If we just say, it's lovely to be free, okay, I believe you, it's lovely to be free. If we compare it with what once was, the difficulties of slavery in Mitzrayim, we appreciate the freedom of today even more. That's number one. Number two, he says that it prevents arrogance. In terms of, you think, look at me, I'm great. Look at the life that I lived. But if we're able to remember that once upon a time we were slaves, and once upon a time our ancestors were of Dei Avodah Zarah, then we're going to come down to earth a little bit and remember we're not necessarily so wonderful. And then his third very interesting idea is that Matchil Bignut Umesayim Bishvach, that appreciating our suffering is what can create greatness. In terms of, we have to look at the past and see what we can learn from it. So the four questions of Manishtana are highlighting the fact that we're doing some things which are represented, or all of these four things represent both freedom and slavery. And we're trying to work out what it is that we're commemorating or remembering on this night. The answer is that we're remembering both for the reasons that it creates a greater appreciation of the present, prevents arrogance, and appreciating our suffering creates greatness. And I would suggest that this falls into the category of Kol HaMarbe L'Saper HaRizem Meshubach, in terms of, even though it will be diverging from the text a little bit, this is one of the things that could be discussed around the Seder table, is, what are we gaining from by knowing and remembering the difficult times of our past? And how should this make us greater? And have that as a discussion around the table. That's a thought there on the Manishtana. Now, third point. So we answer, or we introduce the answer, with Avadim Hayinu L'Faro B'Mitzrayim, that we were slaves unto Paro in Mitzrayim. And we say, HaKadosh Baruch Hu took us out. And if Hashem had not taken us out, Hare Anu V'Aneinu V'Nei V'Aneinu M'Shubadim Hayinu L'Faro B'Mitzrayim, we would still be slaves today to Paro in Mitzrayim. And the Torah Tamima, in his commentary Baruch Shamar, asks, how can we make such an assertion? Why should Shibud Mitzrayim have been any different to all of the other persecutions that we've suffered as a nation over the course of time, where ultimately we've left? We've been in, historically, numerous situations of persecution, and at the end of the day, we've managed to escape from all of them. So why are we saying that we wouldn't have escaped from Shibud Mitzrayim? And his answer is thought-provoking, because he says there's a difference between the very nature of Shibud Mitzrayim and other persecutions. He says usually when we've been persecuted, our enemies have wanted to kick us out. they haven't wanted us around. And certainly if we look at medieval Jewish history, that was certainly true, in the sense that it always ended, persecution ended with expulsion. Whereas Shibud Mitzrayim was different. They didn't want to let us go. They wanted to retain us. So the interesting thing is, of course, that perhaps the most recent persecutions haven't necessarily been like that. If we look at the Shoah, Jews had trouble escaping from Nazi Germany. I don't think they particularly wanted to keep the Jews, though. They wanted to annihilate the Jews. In Soviet Russia, the Jews were not allowed to leave. So it was a different type of persecution. But it was I thought that was a thought-provoking notion there. And then, later on in this paragraph, we're told, V'afilu kulanu chachamim, kulanu levonim, kulanu yodim et ha-Torah. Even if that we know everything, mitzvah leinu saper b'tziat Mitzrayim, it's a mitzvah for us to still talk about Yetziat Mitzrayim. And this is an interesting question. Why should it be that I need to talk, especially at length, about Yetziat Mitzrayim? I can understand maybe there would be an obligation to mention Yetziat Mitzrayim, but if you're a person who knows Kol HaTorah, then why do you need, what are you learning that's new on Seder night that you didn't already know? You're going through the same material. You might hear a nice vort from somebody that you hadn't thought of yet. But essentially, it's all repetition. So Rav Osher Weiss, in his Haggadah Minchat Asher, he makes a very important observation about the nature of the mitzvah of Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim. And this is a point of question. I think I discussed it in tomorrow's Torah talks, I think. Which is the question, what's the difference between the mitzvah of Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim on Seder night and the mitzvah of remembering the Exodus throughout the year? There are lots of answers given. But Rav Osher Weiss makes the observation that on Seder night, it's not just an intellectual mitzvah. The whole year round, it's an intellectual mitzvah. Make mention of this and remember it. On Seder night, it's also an emotional mitzvah, which is independent of knowledge. So, v'afilu kulan chachamim, kulan vonim, kulan yodim et ha-Torah. Even if we're all very wise and we know it all, that's only in terms of knowledge. What we have to do on Seder night is create an emotional experience. And that, I think, is a very big challenge for Seder night. And again, I think perhaps this should be one of the points for discussion round the Seder table. In fact, how can we make ourselves emotionally feel happy about Yetziat Mitzrayim, gratitude for Yetziat Mitzrayim? I mean, this is, one of the fundamentals. We say towards the end of the Magid, B'chol dor v'dor chayav adam lirot et atzmo ki lo yatzah Mitzrayim. It's every generation, the person has to look at themselves as if they personally left Mitzrayim. How do we achieve that? How many of us, by the time we get to the end of the Magid on Seder night, really feel like that? I think this observation of Rav Osher Weiss helps us understand or answer another question that often comes up about the mitzvah of Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim. And that is, why is there no bracha on the Magid on Seder night? Why don't we say a bracha before we start? Sheikh Shalom B'Zotav B'Tzivanu, Nesaper B'Tziat Mitzrayim. Or Lahagid Yetziat Mitzrayim. Why is there no such bracha? So I think with Rav Osher Weiss's observation, we can answer it because the chiddush of this mitzvah is that it's emotional, what we call Dvarim Shebelev, something which there's no action associated with it, but it's an emotion or a thought. And generally speaking, we don't say brachot on things which are emotions or thoughts. Okay, so I now understand why everybody, even the greatest scholars, have to speak about Yetziat Mitzrayim. But not only do we have to speak about it, but Kol ha-mar be'le-saper, harizem shubach. The more we speak about it, the better. And this is a concept that we don't have with any other mitzvah. Nobody's ever said that the more you wave the lulav, harizem shubach, you know, the better. Or the more begadim that a person wears with tzitzit, harizem shubach. Or any other mitzvah that we do. Some mitzvot, you know, we need to constantly be doing, but it's not that, you know, that there's something meshubach in increasing the quantity. With Sipur Yitzhiyah Mitzrayim, there seems to be. Why should that be the case? So again, looking at the Tiferet Shlomo, the Radomska Rebbe, he makes three observations about the important, why this is such an important mitzvah. He says, number one, Sipur Yitzhiyah Mitzrayim strengthens our belief in the might and power of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's about emuna. That's what it's about. It's not just telling a story, but it creates emuna, or it should create emuna. You know, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is powerful enough to do these things. And therefore, it goes beyond, if you like, just the specifics of, you know, of telling the story about leaving Mitzrayim, but it's about embedding in our hearts a belief in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's power. So secondly, it can serve as a sort of prayer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that just as he did these miracles for our nation at the time of Yitzhiyah Mitzrayim, he should repeat them for us in the present exiles that we're experiencing. And he says, thirdly, by speaking more and more about it and coming to appreciate how we've gained from HaKadosh Baruch Hu's graciousness in this regard, it should inspire us to serve Hashem with a greater fealty. And therefore, kol ha-mar be'le-saper, hareze mushubach. Okay, let's move on to a few points about the Shibud Mitzrayim. The fact that we were slaves in Mitzrayim, we darshan the psukim, and that sort of tends to be the bit that very often gets overlooked. People at the Seder table, okay, we go through the four sons, and the Manishtana, and Maaseh Rabbi Eliezer, and all those interesting things, and then we get to Vehisha Amda, and we lift the kos, and we sing it, and we sing the traditional tune, and we sing Shweki's tune, and we sing Shimon Kramer's tune, and then, you know, time's marching on already. So we want to zog through the Pesukim. But the Pesukim are the drashot that Chazal give us on the mitzvah, or on the story of being in Mitzrayim and leaving. So we should certainly pay these drashot some attention. And it's interesting that, you know, how do we tell the story on Seder night? You know, most of the Haggadah is taken from Chazal. You know, it's not really, it's a new composition, but it's not an original composition by and large. You know, big chunks of it are either in the Mishnah or the Tosefta or the Mechilta. So, you know, it's largely Tanaitic. The way we share our history with those around us is by learning Torah with them and seeing what Chazal said. So Vayagor Sham, Yaakov came down to Mitzrayim, Vayagor Sham, and he dwelt there. And the pasuk tells us Shelo Yarad Lishtakeya Elalagor Sham. He didn't come to settle in Mitzrayim. He came just to live there as a stranger, temporarily. And Reb Yaakov Emden makes a wonderful observation about this. Let's think about Yaakov Avinu. Yaakov Avinu was about to emigrate to what at that time was probably the best country in the world. The Middle East was stricken by famine. Mitzrayim had food, was on the Nile, and had water. It's described in Chumash as Gagan Hashem, as the garden of Hashem. Also, it was a very technologically advanced society. It was very, advanced in terms of science and building and such things. And on top of that, Yosef was there. So there was everything to encourage Yaakov Avinu to want to go and live in Mitzrayim. This is the Golden of Medina, as it were. Nevertheless, Yaakov never had any sense that this was home. Despite all its attractions, he was only there Lagur Sham. I think that's very, very important in our own situations. We're all here in Galut. It's very attractive to us. We've got good jobs, more or less, most of us, whatever. Certainly better than our ancestors in the shtetl had, at least most of them. We have nice community, nice Jewish facilities. London is a quite a good place to live in, etc., etc. And we need to realize that, and our friends are here and our family's here very often. Nevertheless, it's lo yarad ishtakeya ela lagur sham. And again, this could be a point of discussion round the Seder table. But once Yaakov came down to Mitzrayim and was somewhat settled there, and the next generation came, vayavidu Mitzrayim et bnei Israel, and the Egyptians enslaved bnei Israel befarech, with rigor. What does it mean with rigor? So the pshat is that it's a very rigorous type of work, backbreaking from morning to night, never stops. Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch makes a fascinating observation about the meaning of the word befarech. What word in other words in Hebrew is it related to? So I might have thought it means related to a pricha, something that's something which is broken and crumbled. But he points out in actual fact that it's and words of course are all related to each other, they've got the same shoresh, pei resh kaf, related to the word parochet. What's a parochet? So we think of the parochet in front of the Aron HaKodesh. We'll say a parochet is a curtain. But think of the parochet in the Mishkan. What was the parochet in the Mishkan? It was there for separation. It was there to separate the Kodesh from the Kodesh HaKodashim. That's the purpose of a parochet. It's to separate what's behind it from what's in front of it. And Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch says that's exactly what the Egyptians wanted to do to Am Yisrael, was to set them apart, to make them different, to define them as being a rejected underclass. That was what it means. Vayavidu Mitzrayim befarech. This was apartheid. It was denying Bnei Yisrael the rights that were enjoyed by the rest of society and making them despised. And that's the meaning of Vayavidu Mitzrayim et Bnei Yisrael befarech. Let's move on now to the plagues, the 10 plagues. The question comes up, again, discussed by quite a number of commentators on the Haggadah. Why these 10 plagues? Why particularly these 10 things? Why couldn't it have been various other things? Why couldn't it have been that, why was it frogs that came out of the water rather than something else? Why was it the water turned to blood rather than the trees stopping giving their fruit or something like that? So the author of the Chaya Adam was Rav Avraham Danzig. He was a Talmid of the Vilna Gaon, wrote a very important Halacha Sefer, Chai Adam and the Chochmat Adam, and he has a Haggadah Shel Pesach called the Toldot Adam, and he says that the Medrash tells us, the Medrash Tanchuma in Parshat Vayera, tells us that all the midot were midah keneged midah. They were all correspond, they were all measure for measure, because the Egyptians did X to Bnei Israel, therefore they were punished with Y. So what were these things? It says, as far as the blood was concerned, the Israelites had been turned into Shoavei Maim. One part of their role was to draw water for their Egyptian masters. And they weren't allowed to wash themselves. And therefore, the Egyptians were punished by the river turning into blood. Also, the Israelites were frightened. The Egyptians were always waking them up in the middle of the night with banging and loud noises to disturb them and that sort of thing. And therefore, the frogs, which were croaking around the place all the time and making this terrible noise, that was midah keneged midah. The Egyptians were also punished by having a loud noise disturb them. The kinim, the lice, were because the Israelites had to work hard sweeping out the alleyways and the marketplaces from all the dirt, and dirt breeds lice, and therefore the Israelites suffered with lice, so the Egyptians had to suffer with lice. Why the wild animals? Because the Israelites also had to go out and hunt wild animals to bring back to their masters. So the Israelites suffered and toiled with wild animals. Their masters were punished with wild animals. And also, even the Israelite animals were pressed into labor for their Egyptian masters. And therefore, the Egyptian animals died in the plague of Tever. The Egyptians constantly beat the Israelites and caused their skin to have welts on it and scabs and scars. So therefore, the Egyptians were punished with shechin, with the boils. Says that they pelted the Israelites with stones. So they were pelted in turn with barad, with the hail. And the Israelites also had to sow crops for the Egyptians. So the Egyptians were punished with the arbe, which destroyed their crops. The Israelites, interesting term, hekshichu einehem shel Yisrael. I would say they put the Israelites into a state of depression where they couldn't see the light at the end of the tunnel. And therefore, they also were denied the ability to see light. And then they killed Israelites, so some of them were also killed. Israel is known as Bani Bechori, Hashem's firstborn, and therefore the Egyptian firstborn were also killed. That appears in the Haggadah of the Toldot Adam. I actually confess, he quotes it from the Medrash Tanchuma in Parashat Va'era, and I didn't look if it was just the concept was there from the Medrash Tanchuma or those details. That's worth looking up. Okay, so that's the plagues. Rabbi Yehuda Hayanotim Bahem Simanim Tzach Adash Ba'achav. Sorry, just go back to the plagues. This is, I think, part of the classic, you know, expounding on Sifur Yetziat Mitzrayim. Is, you know, talking about what exactly happened there through the eyes of Chazal. So therefore, you know, so very often when you get to the 10 plagues, right, it's like, you know, let's just get on with this. You know, let's dip our fingers, spill the wine, and move on to Dayenu, Pesach, Matzah, Maror, we can get up to the meal. But with good planning, maybe a bit more attention could be paid to the 10 Makot. In any event, Rabbi Yehuda Hayanotim Bahem Simanim, he divided them into three groups, Tzach, Adash, Ba'achav. And what's significant about this division? You know, it's kind of interesting. So a number of the Mepharshim point out this was, you know, something that Rabbi Yehuda used to like to do You find in other cases that in actual fact he divided things into groups as mnemonics, which is a way of remembering things. But why should that be included in the Haggadah, if it's so important for us to know that it was done in this way? So again, referring to Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, he makes the observation that the Jewish people were in their persecution in Egypt, the slavery, comprised of a three-pronged experience. Number one, he says, there was an experience of Geirut. They were strangers in a foreign land and made to feel like outsiders. Number two, there was Avdut. They didn't have liberty. And number three, there was Inui. There was oppression. They weren't just slaves, but they were maltreated slaves. And he says, if we look at the plagues, we see that the first one in each category, the Tzachat Ashbachav, represents Geirut, the fact that Am Yisrael had been strangers, and now the Egyptians were being turned into strangers. The dam in the river, how was that to turn them into strangers? The river Nile was what defined Mitzrayim. You know, that was Mitzrayim. Now all of a sudden, it's gone. It's turned to blood. Their national identity was crushed. The Arov and the Barad made it dangerous for them to be outside on their own land. Wild animals roaming the place, hail pelting down, you know, enormous hailstones. You know, that was. That made them feel like they couldn't live there. They had to retreat somewhere. So that was an experience of Geirut. What was the Avdut? So he says the Tzfardeh, the frogs, the Dever, the pestilence, and the Arbeh, the locusts. What did that do? That showed them how foolish they were, and having such pride that they thought they were so great, and now they're. Their houses are overrun by frogs. Their wealth of animals is destroyed by Dever. Their crops are destroyed by Arbeh. And they don't feel good. You know, their most precious possessions are suffering. And therefore, that's a representation of the Avdut. And then you've got the Inui, the persecution, the maltreatment. That came from the Kinim, the Shechin, and the Choshech. And that's why, he says, Rabbi Yehuda divided them into these groups to reflect the notions of Geirut, Avdut, and Inui. Two points to share with you about the Pesach Matzah and Maror. After all, Rabbi Yehuda said that if you don't talk about the Pesach Matzah Maror, lo yatzei ydei chovato. Kol shelo amar shlosha dvarim eilu b'Pesach, lo yatzei ydei chovato. If you don't speak about these three things, you haven't fulfilled your obligation. Discussion in the Rishonim, does that mean you haven't fulfilled your obligation at all? You haven't fulfilled it in the best way? That's which obligation it is you haven't spoken about, etc., etc. But Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch makes an interesting observation about this and says that usually, how do we think, you know, what's unique about Leil HaSeder? I think what we think about is unique about Leil HaSeder is that there are all these props that we use. There's the wine, the maror, the matzah, the dipping, the charoset, the afikoman, all these things that we do. We think that the symbols are the really important things. Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch makes the observation that in addition to the symbols, you also have to have words. It's not just enough for us to do things, but we need to explain and expound. And I think in general, Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch saw the Seder table as being an educational forum. And, you know, it's not good enough for our children, our families, our communities just to see doing things. We need to talk about them. We need to talk about what the significance is, what the symbolism is of all these things. So the matzah. I want to finish off just with the observation, one observation on the matzah from what is always my favourite Haggadah. I've quoted from it many times in previous shiurim, so been a bit sparse on it this year. But it's the Haggadah of the Abarbanel. The Abarbanel, Don Yitzchak Abarbanel, one of the very important Spanish Rishonim, has an important commentary on Tanakh, wrote a Haggadah, a commentary on the Haggadah, Haggadah Zevach Pesach. And it's really the most comprehensive commentary on the Haggadah out of all the Rishonim. Lots of them, wrote small pieces, observations on this phrase, that phrase, etc. He wrote a very comprehensive commentary, like everything of the Haggadah, the Abarbanel. It's very lengthy, but been published, translated, bridged and translated into English by Art Scroll, and well worth getting hold of. Very worthwhile Haggadah, full of beautiful gems. So talking about the matzah, the Haggadah tells us, why do we have the matzah on Seder night? Because Shelohi speak Seikam, because they didn't have a chance to let their dough rise when they left Mitzrayim. Al shum Shelohi speak Seikam Shelavotein lahachmitz, didn't have a chance to become chametz. That's why we have the matzah. But he says, hold on a moment. Haven't we said, well, we know that they ate matzah on the night of Yitziat Mitzrayim. Even before they left Egypt, they ate matzah. Halach ma'anya diachalu avatana barad Mitzrayim. On the night of Yitziat Mitzrayim, our ancestors ate matzah. So what's it coming to commemorate? You know, are we eating matzah at Seder night because of what happened after they left? Or are we eating it to commemorate what happened on that night, reenact what happened on that last night in Mitzrayim? So the Abarbanel's answer is that there are two types of matzah. The matzah that they ate in Mitzrayim was to commemorate the Avdut. They ate lowly matzah then, because they've been lowly people for all those years. The matzah we eat now, though, is to commemorate the chipazon, the fact that we left Mitzrayim in a hurry. That's the purpose of the matzah that we eat now. It is to commemorate that the Exodus, rather than to commemorate the slavery. The matzah to commemorate the slavery was what they ate on that final night of Mitzrayim. But at the end of the day, what we're celebrating on Seder night is the Exodus and the Chipazon, the fact that we left in haste rather than the slavery. So, Kol Amar Ben Esaper Harizem Shabbat. There's a lot more to say on the Haggadah, but those are the points that I wanted to share with you this year. I hope everybody has Chag Kasher V'Sameach, lovely Yom Tov, lovely Sedarim, meaningful Sedarim. And Be'ezrat Hashem will continue these shiurim after Yom Tov. Good night all. Seitchem shalom, Ben Dov.